This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Today, we're starting the show with Lauren Chapman, IPBS digital producer. Lauren makes a lot of the digital magic happen here in the newsroom, including interactive graphics, daily digital stories, and social media. In short, if something is newsworthy in Indiana, it's crossing your desk, Lauren. So today, we're happy to have you join us and to sort of break down some of the headlines that we've seen this past week. Before we jump into it, a reminder that if there is a headline you have questions about or a topic you'd be interested in hearing about or discussing on All In, let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. What stories are you interested in? What topics do you have questions about? We want to know. Lauren, it's great to have you. Thanks for making the time.
Thanks for having me.
So looking back at the headlines last week, where do we even start? What should we be paying attention to? This United Auto Workers strike was a big story.
Yeah, I think the UAW is probably the biggest thing to focus on. It's definitely the one that's going to have the largest and widest impact overall. So the big issues that the UAW is striking against General Motors with is wages, healthcare, and temporary workers, and trying to get all of those things back to pre-recession levels. And so in Indiana, there are a handful of factories and assembly plants that General Motors owns, including the largest one in Fort Wayne. So our business reporter, Samantha Horton, was actually in Fort Wayne for most of the week, talking to workers and trying to figure out exactly, you know, what those big issues were for everyone locally. And kind of what she found out was actually the biggest issue for them is the temporary worker situation. So during the recession, GM basically got a little bit more wiggle room with what could qualify as a temporary worker, someone that they didn't have to necessarily pay health and wage benefits for, paid time off, etc. And so what a lot of folks in Indiana are concerned about is that there have been temporary workers working at GM plants for 2 or 3 years and never receiving those full wage benefits because of this wiggle room that GM and the UAW worked out in 2008 or 2009. So that's kind of where they're trying to push back a lot. But this also has much wider impacts, including on non-GM shops and Indiana's economy as a whole.
When was the last time we saw something like this?
It was actually 2007. That was the last time that UAW put together a strike. And it actually lasted a shorter amount of time than the GM strike that we're currently going through has lasted. This is officially 1 week.
We also had GM facilities, UAW workers in facilities in Bedford and Kokomo and Marion joining in on this strike. Are we feeling the repercussions across the state?
If we're not feeling it right now, we are going to. So as part of Sam's reporting, she did a story with Ball State professor and economist Michael Hicks. And basically, he was laying out what the damage could be, because we're not going to necessarily feel those impacts right this very second. But we are going to feel it in the future. And that's mostly because of the trade war that we're currently engaged with in China. Indiana and the Midwest as a whole, and especially the Rust Belt, are going to face the largest impacts from that trade war, from the tariffs that are being pushed back on farmers and on manufacturers. And so this strike couldn't come at a worse time and couldn't come at a better time for the UAW, because they do know that they have that that leverage. That being said, even on a micro scale, this is having huge impact in individual communities. So going back even to Fort Wayne, there's a plant that's across the street from the GM shop. And they have had people quit because they had to stop production during the UAW strike. Now, they don't have UAW workers there. They're not a GM shop. Nobody's striking in their office. But because they don't have parts coming out of the GM facility across the street, they can't do their jobs either.
You're already getting ahead of me, because that was going to be my next question. How is this affecting people outside the auto industry? I guess that's sort of inside the auto industry,
yeah.
But are there ripples through other parts of the state and other industries?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are more than 4,000 GM workers in the state of Indiana. And if you consider that suddenly the economic impact of those families are being kind of crushed in their communities, while they are striking, GM workers get about $250 $50 per week. And so suddenly the same people that would be going out to eat or be buying, you know, groceries or be, you know, buying retail things, going out and doing things, they are suddenly not able to have that economic impact. So in a very micro sense, for all of these communities, there is a trickle down depression while the strike is happening and will be felt after the strike is over.
So the strike is still ongoing. Mm-hmm. Do we have any indication as to how long this might last?
Not so far. Everyone's from GM and from the UAW. Everyone seems pretty positive about how things are going. And they, you know, there's not a lot of like bad mouthing in the national media. But, you know, in Indiana, we're a little bit farther removed from that larger conversation, that larger negotiation. So far, it could end any day. It could also keep going for a while.
Let's move on to this crazy story out of South Bend about the abortion doctor. Legislators want this deceased doctor investigated after 2,000 plus fetal remains were found, all from Indiana, mm-hmm. in his home.
Mm-hmm.
What is going on here?
It's one of those really weird stories that, like, it feels like it's very newsworthy, but it's also just like the wonkiness factor is incredibly high. So 2,246 fetal remains meticulously medically preserved, along with the records for those fetal remains, were discovered on Ulrich Klopfer's Illinois property in Will County, Illinois. We don't know. There's a lot of questions that we have not answered. For example, we don't know why he has it or had. He is deceased. He died on September 3rd. And those remains.
So he's recently deceased. Okay.
Yeah. He died at the beginning of September. And then 2 weeks later, his family found all of those remains and then reported it immediately to police and have been cooperating with all the investigations. So we don't know why he had all of those fetal remains. We don't know why, what he had done with those remains. But what we do know as of Friday, because the attorney general's office spoke a little bit about the investigation and some of the goals, because you can't prosecute someone who's dead. So what they're looking for, and what they've discovered so far, actually, is that all of those fetal remains are from the state of Indiana. They're all from a time period between 2000 and 2002, through the end of 2002. So all of those fetal remains come from Indiana. But they're also concerned about the potential crimes that those remains come from. So, for example, in 2016, Klopfer's license to practice in the state of Indiana was revoked after he performed an abortion for a minor under the age of 12 and did not report it to the state of Indiana. He needed to report it because that's indicative of a larger crime. And that's the reason his license was revoked. So the concern is from lawmakers and from the attorney general's office that this could be indicative of a larger number of crimes that he might have been covering up, that he might have been using those fetal remains for research. There's just a lot of unanswered questions when it comes to this.
Well, with the divisiveness of this kind of an issue, I can imagine. I mean, this story has already taken a very national prominence, I think.
Yeah.
And I can only see it getting bigger, and it's going to continue. As the Attorney General's office looks into it, we're going to hear more about this.
Definitely. But I think it's also really interesting. Of course, Attorney General Curtis Hill is extremely pro-life, very often talks about, you know, being anti-abortion. But during his conversation on Friday with reporters, he said, and it was very interesting to hear him say this, he was very specific that this wasn't, that he didn't want this investigation to turn into an anti-abortion or pro-abortion discussion, that it was instead about, you know, 2,200 you know, people.
But how could it not, is my question, because anyone who is against abortion can see this ghastly thing happen mm-hmm. and sort of point to it as in and sort of vilify this deceased doctor and say, these are the people who are doing this.
Absolutely. Which is why it does seem kind of interesting to me that the attorney general very specifically is saying, hey, that's not really it. We're trying to focus on, you know, the laws of the land in 2000 to 2002, which was that you couldn't transport fetal remains across state lines and that they had to be disposed of property, whether by cremation, medical waste disposal, or burial. And so that seems to be the only goal from the Attorney General's office.
I wonder what justice looks like in this case. This doctor is already deceased. I mean, what? I wonder what could be done. That remains to be seen, I imagine.
Yeah. Especially from the Attorney General's office, he has a hotline phone number and an email address for former patients of Klopfer from that time period to make sure that their medical records are secure. That's basically the big thing that he's hoping to provide. And of course, make sure that those fetal remains are dealt with in a way that is respectful.
We've got about 2 minutes left. I think maybe enough time to talk about this. Climate marches. An IU researcher says that they are effective, despite some words from to the contrary that are floating out there amid the recent climate strike, I guess.
Yeah. It's really interesting that, you know, bystanders were skeptical that people could come together and solve these big problems like climate change. And what his research found, Nathan Geiger, found that actually, surprisingly, people consuming conservative media had become less pessimistic after the marches. So it's really interesting that you see, and especially because they're youth focused, I think that it's really interesting to see, you know, teenagers and young adults coming together and being like, no, we're going to fix our world. And I think that might be particularly heartening to someone who is concerned about global climate change. I happened to be walking past the protests on Friday and saw some really good signs and really cool signs. And it was just really incredible to me to see somebody who's, you know, 13, 14 years old becoming politically active, becoming civically engaged on something that really matters to them, especially in such a large problem like climate change.
Now, are you a good estimator with your eyes? How many people – this was at the State House when you walked by. How many people did you see? I mean, how full was it, I suppose?
There were a couple hundred kids – I say kids, teenagers and young adults who are out there. And we know across the state that you know, there were hundreds more in at Lafayette, at Purdue, in Muncie and across the entire state.
Lauren Chapman, thank you so much for filling us in. We're looking forward to having you join us again very soon to give us the rundown on Indiana news and headlines and probably some of these exact same stories very soon.
Hopefully, yeah.
When we come back, we'll be hearing from Side Effects reporter Carter Barrett as she brings us her reporting on how cultural training is helping doctors to treat refugees. We'll also hear an interview with Dr. Rachel Katznellen-Bogan, who will introduce us to her book, Women Rock Science, A Pocket Guide for Success in Clinical Academic Research Careers. That's next on All In. Stay with us. We're now joined by Side Effects reporter Carter Barrett, who's been reporting on how cultural training helps doctors treat refugees and other immigrants. Carter, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
This type of cultural training is often associated with big coastal cities, but in fact, it is prevalent in communities right here in Indiana as well. Professionals have been calling for more cultural training in medicine to better serve refugees and immigrants in their medical care. Can you talk about the changes in cultural composition that have been happening in those communities?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the south side of Indianapolis right here, there's quite a sizable Burmese refugee community. And these are people from the country of Myanmar who are fleeing violence there and have settled here. And that's not necessarily a super new thing either. But you're also seeing a growing subset of Congolese and Hispanic immigrants as well.
You found a newspaper article that gave some insight into the historical context of this particular community. And what did you find?
Yeah, that was super interesting. I mean, it was a newspaper clipping from 1965 that said the area of Greenwood used to have a sundown law that would prohibit African Americans from being out after dark. And not surprisingly, this community was almost all white. But now if you go down to the south side, you see, I mean, lots of international grocery stores, lots of international restaurants, a really diverse community.
What exactly is this training talking about? Are we talking about a language barrier? Are we talking about a cultural barrier? Are we talking about ways to talk to these people who are not from here in ways that are appropriate to them, but maybe wouldn't necessarily be appropriate to us or wouldn't be as obvious?
I mean, I think it's all of the above.
Yeah.
You know, it's talking through the language barrier, which is, you know, working with interpreters, working with translators. But then it's also, you know, some of the cultural considerations and how, you know, maybe in a different country, people have a different relationship with their doctor or a hospital. you know, that those sort of considerations as well. So I'd say it's all of the above. It's really practical stuff all the way to stuff that's more big picture, more communicating with people across the language barrier, but then also the how and why and making sure that gets across when you're talking to your patients.
So what are the medical implications then of not being able to clearly communicate with your doctor? A few come to mind. I mean, they need to know the big picture.
Yeah, absolutely. And the implications of that is people not understanding what their doctors are telling them, which can be extremely dangerous. You know, if you're trying to communicate really serious medical issues, like, you know, you need to take this medication in the morning and the night. What if, I don't know, you misunderstood me and you thought, oh, I just need to do it in the morning or at night? You can pick, you know, stuff like that. That's minute details that can be misinterpreted.
So this word, maybe it's a name, comes up with respect to this reporting that you've done. What is MARTI?
Yeah, that's MARTTI. You know, if I'm going to describe what it looks like an iPad on a rolling stand that the doctors and the nurses can wheel around. And if a doctor and their patient were sitting together in a, you know, in a doctor's office and the patient doesn't speak English or is even hard of hearing, they can bring in this iPad on a rolling stand with the MARTI system on it. And it has over 250 languages on it. Many of those are two-way video. So they can click on the iPad and it brings up a two-way video with an interpreter, or sometimes it's just audio. But it allows them to bring in an interpreter, especially for languages like Burmese, or I saw it demonstrated with Hakka Chin, which is a dialect of Burmese. And I mean, it's difficult to find people who speak those languages. So having it on the iPad is like very
helpful. This is a big step beyond, say, Google Translate, where you can type something in and it translates roughly what you said. This is an actual interpreter working through this sort of app. It's almost like Uber for interpreters.
Yeah, exactly. It's a real person. And a big part of the push for a real person is because, you know, they're meant to pick up on the cultural clues that, you know, something like Google Translate would obviously not pick up, you know, not just the word for word translation of what somebody's saying, but the meaning behind what they're saying, you know. So it's definitely supposed to pick up on that. And, you know, and having the video and being able to see, you know, body language and hands moving and that sort of stuff is a big deal.
Are there limitations, though, to this technology?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, when I sat in on training with residents, they said the number one best option is actually to have a provider that speaks the language. That is not always a realistic option. The next best thing is having an interpreter there in the room with you. And the third option would be this MARTI system, the two-way video audio system. And, you know, I mean, just technologically, you have issues, lag. You can't hear what the other person's saying. You know, if you've used FaceTime, I think you can imagine some of the technological issues. But also in the training that I sat in on, the person who is like sitting in on the demonstration who speaks, she's fluent in Burmese and English, was using the Burmese translator through the MARTI and said that there were things that were maybe a little misinterpreted, lost in translation. Stuff, you know, I think Dr. Parlberg had asked her, how did you make this appointment to get a sense for, you know, how are you getting in contact with the doctor's office? And it was interpreted to her via the MARTI as, how did you get to this appointment physically? So, you can hear the residents sort of in these trainings grappling with this, worrying about, you know, things being mistranslated. And I think to an extent, it's unavoidable a little bit.
So as part of this training, there are considerations that are shared with doctors that they need to make when communicating with the interpreter as well.
Yeah.
Like jargon and long sentences, which can be problematic when translating from one language to another. And establishing that clear communication is essential. But even beyond the issue of language, cultural competency, which we kind of touched on, is another consideration. Can you talk about what role cultural understanding plays in this kind of effective care?
I mean, I think it's important to say that when looking at a culture, you shouldn't speak about, you know, all like Hispanic people, for instance, as a monolith. Like there's tons of different little subsets and everybody is different and everybody needs to be talked about as an individual. And I think anybody who's providing this sort of training would say exactly that. But I think also being aware that there are broad cultural considerations is important. And I have some tape from Dr. Parlberg, Dr. Adam Parlberg. He's a physician at this clinic. He helps train the residents. Here's him talking about it.
But for example, you know, like Burmese patients, they tend to be, you know, quieter, tend to be more deferential, you know, to, you know, physicians and, you know, may sort of not in agreement, you know, even if they don't quite understand, you know, a certain point or an instruction, you know, it's a very polite culture, you know. So, I mean, depending on, you know, sort of the patient, you know, you may need to be a little bit more, you know, assertive or, you know, just understand the patient has, you know, understanding and recognition, you know, or has comprehended.
How does mental health fit into this conversation?
Sure. And I mean, mental health is already something that I think there's a lot of stigma around generally, but talking about certain cultures, it can be really taboo to talk about mental illness, mental health, depression. And a great example that I learned about during watching this training was in Burma, in Burmese, there's not a word for anxiety. So even that alone is something difficult to talk about. And so as a physician, being one aware that it can be really hard for people to talk about, and especially if you're dealing with refugees, that is such a traumatic experience. You know, you're fleeing violence, persecution. You can spend decades in a refugee camp and then coming to a completely new culture that you're expected to assimilate in. I mean, it's extremely difficult. I have this another clip of Dr. Adam Parlberg from this clinic talking a little bit about why it's important as physicians to address this.
Yeah, so the CDC sort of, you know, for trauma-informed care, you know, 50% of people, you know, have experienced some sort of trauma. And the study that was done, only 3% of people actually told their doctor about it, and none of them were asked about it, you know, like none. So the CDC recommends asking two questions. So, I mean, are you a victim of violence in your former country? And if so, would you like to describe what happened to you? And at least that opens the door, you know, to sort of discussing and talking about trauma they've experienced, you know, in mental health.
Carter, what about medical schools? I'm sure that on that level, things are changing too with respect to cultural competency.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I think, you know, the students are on the, from the people I talk to, the students are really on the forefront of asking for these experiences, pushing for these experiences. You see a lot of student-run free clinics, that sort of thing. And I think it's changing, but I guess the caution of a metric around this would be, what does that mean? Is that, you know, an hour of one class? Is that a semester-long course? Like, what does that mean? And to the extent, I don't think there's a great metric for it.
Well, it's important that that's being done, and especially with respect to that kind of training. I think experience is the best way to deal with that. Thanks to our Side Effects reporter, Carter Barrett, for bringing us that story. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for your reporting. Speaking of movement and progress in the medical field, in September, the American Medical Association celebrates Women in Medicine Month. We sat down with Dr. Rachel Katzenellenbogen earlier this month to talk about a book she and co-author Megan Moreno wrote to provide guidance to women pursuing a career in clinical academic medicine. Rachel, you're co-author of Women Rock Science, a pocket guide for success in clinical academic medicine. Can you tell us what inspired you to write this book?
My co-author and I, Megan Moreno, trained together in adolescent medicine at the University of Washington. And both she and I had a focus in doing research in pediatrics and followed parallel paths where we really recognized that we were doing well in our research, but had found that there were gaps in recommendations, mentoring, things that we found were ideas and concepts that would be helpful for other people in the future. And it didn't just fit into a 2-hour workshop or a 1-hour lecture or even a short article in a research journal. It was something that was enough to fill a book. So we decided to write a book.
What are the unique challenges of forging a career in clinical academic medicine or in research?
Well, I think if you're thinking about research in clinical academic medicine, it's the title of it tells you why it's a challenge. So it's clinical. So a lot of people who do research in clinical academic medicine also have responsibilities taking care of patients. It's academic. So you are part of your responsibilities making sure you're training other people in research or in clinical care. And it's medicine, so it has to do with the health and wellness of people. And so including all of those components together can be a challenge when you're thinking about research. The flip side of that is it makes it really interesting. There's a lot of depth to the type of work you can do as a researcher, and there are lots of different ways you can approach research questions if you're a clinician or a researcher really interested in clinical health.
Well, now, in addition to that, I'm sure that being a woman in the field carries with it its own unique challenges as well.
Yeah, I think that any person who decides that they want to be doing research in an academic institution, whether it's a university or a research institute, you need to think about all the things that you're balancing. And that happens with anyone who has a family, whether you're a man or a woman. But we all go through those processes together. And I think the other thing to consider is that women have a lot of strengths that can help them as well.
Yeah. And what would be some examples of that that would differentiate?
So one of the things that we talk about at the start of our book is some of the qualities that if you look at women as a whole, it can be found within that group of people. So there was a study looking at 45 different research studies looking at women as leaders in research. And they found that women as a whole were had greater strengths in being transformational leaders. And those are leaders who are transparent in their thought processes, pull in the opinions and strengths of other members of their organization, of their team, and work to actually transform the whole group as a part of their leadership style. Having that as a strength when you're thinking about research is very important.
You encourage readers not just to listen to pointers and guidance from the book, but to also engage in self-reflection. What are the types of things you encourage readers to reflect upon?
Well, one of the things that we do for each of our chapters is have objectives at the start. This is what we hope you're going to glean from this chapter when you read it. And at the end, we have some take-home points and some homework for people to do. So anyone who does research, you do a lot of homework. Took a lot of homework to get you where you are. You continue to do homework as a researcher. So we felt that that was a low bar for people to need to do or request of a reader if they're reading this book. And some of the things are thinking about what really makes you excited when you're thinking about research. What's the way in which you want to conduct your research? What are the resources that you have out there? Who are five people you could identify as a mentor? How would you set up those meetings? How would you develop an oversight committee to help look broadly across your career and have people do those exercises to develop a really strong context in which they're doing their work?
I would venture to guess that a lot of people in a lot of lines of work don't take a lot of time to reflect. Why is that kind of reflection important?
I think it's important in a lot of jobs. Just as you said, a lot of people don't do it. It doesn't mean it's not important. I think people sometimes don't feel that they have enough time in order to carve out personal reflection about what their job is like right now and how they want it to be. But research is something that is a really long process. It takes a long time to study something with fidelity and to move the field forward. So it takes a lot of thought at the start to see how you can point your direction to make sure that you are reaching your goals in a timely manner.
What movement do you see in academia and the workplace that excites you about women in science?
I would first say that I like that there's a growing minority of women and in some fields, majority of women. Women are interested in science. Girls are interested in math and science when they're growing up. And I would love for that to be maintained all the way through high school, college, postgraduate studies, and being primary principal investigators as well. So I am very excited about that. I would also say that there are women in science now and women who've been trailblazers in science starting from decades ago who really have created the path that I'm taking now. My mother is a researcher. She is a PhD who's conducted research for almost 50 years, and she hit many more walls than I have in my career. But it's really exciting to see that those paths have been blazed by others and to just help build on that momentum.
She's the author of Women Rock Science, A Pocket Guide for Success in Clinical Academic Medicine, Dr. Rachel Katzenellenbogen. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Here in our studios at 16th and Meridian, we're just a few blocks north of the Indiana World War Memorial. In fact, The only city in the country with more memorials to veterans than Indianapolis is actually Washington, D.C. itself. So Indiana is dedicated to veterans and members of the armed forces. So when one of our own comes back and wants to tell their story, we want to hear it. Joining me in the studio is co-author of a new book, Hunting the Caliphate, America's War on ISIS and the Dawn of the Strike Cell, retired Major General with the U.S. Army, Dana Pittard. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, Matt, thank you for having me.
You write that you witnessed some pretty difficult things in your military career. How hard is it to deal with some of those memories?
You know, the toughest ones are the ones, I think, from combat when you've lost someone you've worked with, you served with. That's always tough. And then I guess it's a different way of looking at life, which is you want to make sure you live your life in an honorable way that brings some honor to that person's memory. So there's difficulty there. And then there's also the idea that that you survived and they didn't, because for those who have been in combat, you know that bullets flying or explosions going off, it can hit anybody. So in some ways, you feel some survivor's guilt too.
Well, and indeed, you bring up a lot of them in this book. So you had to kind of reckon with them to get them just down on the page. What was that like? I mean, how much time did you have to take away from writing when you were writing about particularly difficult things?
This is a 4-year project to the extent. I wrote it on the weekends, sometimes late at night going through it. And sometimes, you just have to step back and think about it. But this war against ISIS was a war that needed to be fought. ISIS was a scourge, brutal, murderous terrorist group that took over a third of Iraq's territory. And they had ambitions to do things in the West and in America, evil things. So they needed to be stopped.
Time heals a little, certainly not all. How much time had passed between coming home for good and starting work on the book? Like, when did the germ hit your brain?
It actually, before I retired and before I even deployed back, believe it or not, an elementary school friend called. I was in Baghdad. He said, you ought to write a book. I said, never thought about that. And then he called back and said, I have a friend of a friend, knows a literary agent, and she's going to give you a call. I said, really, Paul, you got a lot of things going on. Well, sure enough, Jan Miller called. She's a literary agent. I had Googled her right beforehand. Amazing who she's worked with. T.D. Jakes, Arnold Schwarzenegger, just some really big names. And she called and said, I understand you're interested in the book or interested in writing a book. And I said, well, I'm thinking about it. She said, well, it'll be about 10 chapters. How about writing a paragraph for each the 10 chapters and then two whole chapters and give me a synopsis and send it to me. Like, okay. So it really caused me to really look inward and really pull out a story. And that's where the co-author came in. I'd asked different people I'd worked with over there in Iraq to send me anecdotes and a couple sentences. Well, he ended up sending me 25 pages, and it was so well written. I was like, you want to be my co-author? So that's how that partnership started.
I always wonder about that. I'm sure there are a lot of people in the military who have lots of stories to tell. And indeed, we've been at war in Afghanistan since the early 2000s. And so lots of people have been in the military, and I'm sure there are lots of stories to tell. But I'm sure that they just choose not to tell them because they themselves maybe don't want to think about it. Do you think it's important to share these stories, or are there people who simply can't? It's too difficult for them. What's the balance?
Well, I do think people ought to share their stories. It's therapeutic in some ways, but it also helps to inform the American people, because the bottom line is we serve the American people and America's interests when you're in the military. So it's important that Americans know what their military is doing. There's a lot of really good things that the United States military is doing out there to not only defend American interests, but to maintain the peace. So that's extremely important. And then the idea of this story is how it came about. ISIS attacked Iraq. It's a terrorist organization, but very, very well organized with an army. Took over Iraq's second largest city, Mosul, which had over 1 million people. And then it alarmed the world. And then within 10 days to 2 weeks, I was sent to Baghdad with 100 advisors to look at options. Number one was to protect American interests there, the embassy, other American property, and then to possibly evacuate U.S. citizens. Now, this was in 2014. It had just been 2 years since Libya, Tripoli, where unfortunately our ambassador Stevens was killed. So there was a lot of concern from the State Department, the Defense Department, and the administration at that time, it was President Obama, that we didn't want that to happen. And ISIS was on a roll. They seemed like they were a juggernaut that seemed unstoppable. If you look at maps of Iraq, from Mosul, they were coming down the Tigris River Valley, which goes from north to south towards Baghdad. They were going in from the west, the Euphrates Valley. In fact, when I showed up at the embassy, the defense attaché there was saying, ISIS is coming. They're going to take Baghdad. They're going to take it. You know, he was one of those almost comic scenes where I wanted to just slap him and say, "Come on, man, keep your sense about you." But there was a lot of concern. And in fact, a third of the embassy had already evacuated at that point, where they were sent to other embassies in the Middle East or other areas, safer areas in Iraq. So that was the expectation, was to monitor what was going on initially. But within the first 48 hours, I made a bold call. After talking to the senior Iraqi military, who I had known for years, and that was that Baghdad was not going to fall. I did believe that the Iraqi army could defend Baghdad. That was a bold call then, because five whole divisions of the Iraqi army had been defeated at Mosul, and at least folks in the administration, State Department, Defense Department, didn't think that the Iraqi army was up to the task.
Is it true when it comes to this book that this is the first on the fight against ISIS written by soldiers themselves?
Yes.
I mean, that's kind of
soldiers
hard to believe.
And airmen. I mean,
soldiers and airmen.
Yeah.
With regard to this book, it took a while for the the Pentagon and the CIA. They had to look at it, and they had to run a classified screening of the book, right? And they wanted to make sure that nothing would compromise current operations.
Right. And we certainly don't want to compromise current operations either. But it normally takes 60 to 90 days to get through the Pentagon screeners, but it took 15 months. 15 months. So the book is on the edge in many ways, and it's quite revealing. We went back and forth with the Pentagon, like, okay, now why is this classified? Well,
that was going to be my other question. What did they say? What did they clear? And what did they – I mean, obviously you can't say what they didn't clear, right. But
– Well, we got to talk about the topics that any mention of Delta Force had to be taken out. Obviously, we worked very closely with them, and there was other smaller things. But for the most part, it's intact. So it really is a neat and in some places very very thrilling story that is true and what occurred.
You shared a little bit about Middle East history and kind of how this all came about, and you know a little bit more about our involvement there and how all of this happened.
I do. Actually, I've spent 5 years deployed in the Middle East through numerous combat tours. And on this one, I'd been in the Middle East for a year. I was at that time the deputy commanding general of U.S. Army Central, which was the Army component command of CENTCOM, Central Command, which has the Middle East for the United States. It was at the end of the year tour when ISIS decided to attack Iraq, and then I was extended a year. So that in itself was a 2 year tour.
The title of the book, of course, is Hunting the Caliphate, America's War on ISIS and the Dawn of the Strike Cell. Can you tell me a little bit more about the strike cell and why that made it into the title?
Sure. The strike cell is almost an evolutionary concept. When we began to actually fight ISIS, and it took a while to do that, and that wanted to pursue ISIS with airstrikes immediately once we got on the ground. But we weren't allowed to really do that for 6 weeks. It was really based on ISIS making mistakes. ISIS made a strategic error in attacking Kurdistan, which has a lot of friends in D.C. and the United States. And so that's when President Obama finally authorized us to conduct airstrikes, but very restrictive. Wouldn't allow us to have our air controllers, JTACs, on the ground. So we had to get innovative on how to do that. Well, America has an enormous amount of manned and unmanned aerial intelligence systems, drones, predator drones, and all sorts of things. We, for the first time on such a large scale, took advantage of that. We put the JTACs into really a state-of-the-art control center, command and control center, probably about 30 people in there. In front of us, 8 flat screens where we could look at and monitor. So much was going on. The boots on the ground would be the Iraqi army, the Kurdish Peshmerga, which is Kurdish military forces. And through having special operations folks at their command and control centers, being able to quickly translate back for air support, and then we're able to see many of our JTACs, and it was Special Operations JTACs led by Wes Bryant and an F-18 pilot, but it included Navy SEALs, Army Green Berets, and Air Force Special Ops. They were skeptical at first. They said, no, we're used to being in Afghanistan on the ground. And then they saw what we were able to see, and it's like, we see more than we would have seen on the ground. So ISIS could not hide from us. And so this strike cell we were able to conduct airstrikes and bringing multiple different munitions against ISIS on a large scale. Had never been done like that on such a large scale from a strike cell. So that's where, and I've said, this is an evolutionary concept, is the emergence of the strike cell.
Well, I'm sure that you're well aware of some of the criticism against that kind of warfare. I'm sure that you've heard any number of comments from people, but this isn't exactly an enemy who plays by the rules either.
Not at all. ISIS was extremely brutal. In fact, the Yazidis, which was a kind of a tribe in Iraq, and they really attempted to kill them all. It was genocide, attempting to. We were able to stop that. But anyone who didn't believe in their version of Islam either had to convert or was killed. And it was a different strain of Sunni Islam. So they were against the Shias. That's the majority of Iraq. The Iraqi government is primarily Shia. Iranians are Shia. So they were very, very brutal and murderous. And they were just killing all sorts of people. In fact, they murdered over 3,000 Iraqi soldiers who had surrendered outside of Mosul. And we didn't find that out until 2017. We dug up this mass grave, the largest mass grave in Iraq. When we were helping the Iraqi forces out and assisting them with airstrikes, again, almost being initially their will, because they had been humiliated by ISIS and thought they needed 2 more years to get ready. And that's in the book also, where talking to the Iraqi senior leaders and saying, no, you have just as much training, in fact, more training than ISIS. What you need now is the will to fight, and we're here for you. That's why I ended up in the strike cell sometimes during particular campaigns. I wanted to ensure that there was no issue. I was also what's called the TEA, the Target Engagement Authority. It has to be a general officer to approve them. So we did things very close. It was often danger close. I sometimes got called on the carpet on how close it was. But we made sure that no civilians were hurt. No innocent civilians, what's often called collateral damage, but that no civilians were hurt. I take a lot of pride in that. We got after ISIS. But as there was success, what we found is within 24 to 72 hours of a successful battle against ISIS, where ISIS was defeated, ISIS started murdering Western hostages and beheading hostages. In fact, that was something that weighed on us, because after a while, obviously we saw that pattern. We knew that when we were successful, that one of the Western hostages, even Americans, would be brutally murdered. In fact, ISIS continued to do that until they ran out of hostages.
Politicians like to take credit for military victories. It's been said that President Obama failed to defeat ISIS and that President Trump succeeded. Do you have thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah. It's much more complicated than that. Yes. I was one of the people on the ground who was pushing the Obama administration that we had to take action, that ISIS was, in fact, there's clear and present danger, an existential threat. I mean, President Obama came in what, in 2008 to kind of end wars, to get us out of Afghanistan, get us out of Iraq. He got us out of Iraq in 2011. He had really reduced the forces in Afghanistan. So there was a reluctance to now fight ISIS. It was like, wait a minute, that's an Iraqi problem. But what we tried to convince, and I think successfully, is that, wait a minute, that Iraqi problem is a sovereign nation that has a democratic government that is now being invaded by a terrorist organization, a democratic government that we helped to create. So we needed to take action. The campaign plan that was developed under President Obama, and that's what was being executed when President Trump took office. But I will say that what President Trump did allow is more freedom of action for commanders on the ground, and that's appreciated. So that certainly helped. It was still following the campaign. ISIS would have been defeated anyway, but I think ISIS was defeated a little faster with President Trump allowing commanders a little bit more freedom of action on the ground.
ISIS has, of course, been seriously reduced. What more needs to be done?
Well, ISIS as a caliphate, which was a geographical location, they had their capital in the city of Raqqa in eastern Syria. ISIS as a state or wannabe state has been defeated. However, ISIS as a terrorist organization still exists, and ISIS is still popping up in ungoverned locations, failed states like Somalia, even Libya. ISIS is in Afghanistan. So ISIS has not been totally defeated yet.
The book is Hunting the Caliphate, America's War on ISIS and the Dawn of the Strike Cell, retired Army Major General and Hoosier veteran Dana Pittard. Thanks for your service and thanks for coming on All In.
Oh, thank you.
Next time on All In, we'll look at the life and legacy of labor union pioneer and presidential candidate Eugene V. Debs. He's the subject of a new WFYI documentary that's premiering on Friday night in Terre Haute on the ISU campus. That show is Thursday at 1 p.m. and we hope to see you then. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.